You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Over 50 years ago, Dr. Culver Bill Nelson was the pastor of the Beatitudes Church here in Phoenix and grew that congregation into the largest UCC church in the country. He was also a fellow of the original Jesus Seminar and for almost 10 years edited their journal, The Fourth R. For nearly 50 years, Bill preached the kinds of things you hear me preaching about. And I wanted to acknowledge Bill as the source of a couple of today's great stories and being the inspiration for the core of today's message. Our text this morning is a post-Easter episode that is unique to Luke. The story picks up on Easter morning with two depressed disciples heading from Jerusalem to their hometown, Emmaus. One is named in the story, Cleopas. His companion was unnamed, which wasn't unusual for storytellers of the time to do if the person was a woman. They're feeling wrung out and defeated. The man they thought would be king had been given a crown of thorns and executed. As they walk along, they're joined by a stranger who inquires about their situation and begins to unpack some scripture for them. But as they're typical disciples, they're pretty clueless. They don't recognize the stranger as Jesus. Our story picks up as they get to their front door and have to convince this stranger to stay for a meal.
Our words of wisdom are from Luke chapter 24, verses 28 through 32. As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on, but they urged him strongly, saying,
"Stay with us, because it is almost evening and the day is now nearly over."
So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other,
"Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?"
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Easter always has me feeling a bit like Omar Bradley. In his memoir, he tells about a trip traveling on a commercial airline. The celebrated general was dressed in civilian clothes and eager to get a bit of work done on the flight. As fate would have it, an extroverted young army private was in the seat next to him. He turned to the general and said, "Well, it looks like we'll be traveling together for several hours and ought to get acquainted. I take it you're probably a banker." Chit-chat was the last thing the general wanted to deal with, and so he said, "No, I am Omar Bradley, a 5-star general in the United States Army and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, D.C. Unperturbed, the young man responded, "Wow, sir, that's an important job. I hope you don't blow it." Well, that's a bit how I feel about preaching on Easter. After all, the Easter story is a minefield of conflicting information and preconceived dogma that smarter pastors opt to not point out. But I can't help myself. I want you to know what I know, and not because I'm privy to some secret information, but just because I've actually read the Bible. Like the birth narratives, the story of the first Easter is told in many different ways. Who saw what first? The number of angels at the tomb and Jesus' appearance. All vary from gospel to gospel. Counting Paul, there are really 5 explicit accounts of Easter, none written by a contemporary, much less by an eyewitness. Paul's is the earliest account and is really just part of a creed he was taught and not written down until 20 years after the event. The next account, Mark, comes over 40 years after Easter. Matthew wrote in the 80s, The Gospel of John most likely comes from the 90s, and a Minority Report is pushing for Luke, having been written in the 120s. Mark and Matthew both say that Jesus will appear to his followers back in Galilee. On the other hand, Luke insists that the disciples must not return to Galilee, but stay in Jerusalem to meet Jesus there. So which is it? Mark has three visitors to the tomb. Matthew has two. John has only one. In Mark and Luke and John, a large stone has already been rolled away. In Matthew, an earthquake rolls it away in the visitor's presence. So what the heck is going on? Well, it's complicated. The idea of Jesus' resurrection is probably the most ballyhooed event in Western history, and at the same time, one of the least understood. Much of the confusion comes from generations of preachers counting on the fact that their constituents don't have a clue what's in the Bible. It empowers them then to not be honest about what's right on the page. So I encourage you to not be one of those people. Take some time to read the Easter accounts in each of the Gospels and soak up the richness of their stories. Don't be afraid to note discrepancies and ask the same questions of the text that you'd ask when you're reading any book. And hopefully, in the process, you'll get a feel for what each of the Gospel writers was up to. But I'll give you a hint. What each of the Gospel writers was doing was trying to illustrate something that can only be described as a new way of seeing. If you think the story is about some whiz-bang supernatural event that happened thousands of years ago that causes us to say, "Wow!" and then just go on about our business, you're missing the point. The Easter stories are meant to inspire us to a new way of seeing here and now, of a new way of interpreting things here and now, about a new way of making sense of the world. Look, we can never know exactly what happened on that first Easter, but in their own ways, each gospel writer showed Jesus' followers seeing the world in a new way. We're told in our text from this morning that the disciples who were walking and talking with Jesus himself didn't recognize him. They didn't see him. It was only when they insisted on sharing a meal and breaking bread together that they got it. And poof, he was gone, leaving them to ponder how, if they want to see Jesus, if they want Jesus to still be with them, they can do it by sharing their resources and being on about the same work that Jesus was on about. In the early years of Christianity, a critic named Celsus wrote blistering attacks against the fledgling church, including, "The root of Christianity is an excessive valuation of the human person, and the even more absurd idea that God takes an interest in humans. Everyone is welcomed among these Christians. Sinners, persons devoid of understanding, children, even cripples. How God will build his kingdom out of such trash, I cannot imagine." Celsus saw the world in one way. Jesus saw it in another. And at their best, Christians have been at the forefront of seeing the world differently. Rather than cling selfishly to their own comfort and well-being, followers of Jesus express concern for what happens to the poor, the elderly, children, and stand up for the dignity and worth of all people, including and perhaps especially our enemies. But that means overcoming our fears, being vulnerable, overcoming our fixation on self to the exclusion of a hurting world, and seeing the world in a new way. Many of you know that I'm not a big fan of Columbus, and if you want to know why, you can Google my HuffPost column. Just don't read the hundreds of nasty responses there. In short, Despite Columbus being an irredeemably greedy and murderous slave trader, and nowhere near deserving his own holiday, he did change the world, and in more ways than you know. Columbus biographer Samuel Eliot Morison claims that the intrepid navigator didn't just stumble upon a new world, he rescued the old world from one of history's darkest moments of pessimism. On July 12, 1492, the otherwise dependable Nuremberg newspaper solemnly predicted the end of the world in 1493. All of Europe embraced and wallowed in this gloomy prediction. But despite the doomsayers, Columbus's three tiny ships wandered their way into the future. And in fact, you might say the world did come to an end that year. At least the world as people knew it. But something completely new was born, and people saw the world in a whole new way after that. Perhaps nothing changed my way of seeing the world than my mom's heart attack back in 2014. There I was, having rushed to the hospital, sitting in the emergency room all alone. My dad was quarantined at home with the norovirus, and literally not another human being in the whole place. With no word on her condition, just the code blue alarms going off and hospital staff running back and forth down the hall, a profound sense of helplessness came over me. But when I look back over the following days and weeks, I remember that sense of helplessness being transformed into a sense of attentiveness. It was like having the volume turned way up on just how precious life was. And in the face of having been run right up to the edge of death, life seemed more vibrant. And I think that's what the gospel writers are trying to convey in their Easter stories, especially when nothing turns out the way you'd imagined. You're invited to see life in a whole new way, as a place where the Spirit is drawing us forward through however much pain, as part of the soul-making process. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, known for her book on death and dying, wrote, "Learning lessons is a little like reaching maturity. You're not suddenly more happy, wealthy, or powerful, but you understand the world around you better, and you're at peace with yourself. Learning life's lessons is not about making your life perfect, but about seeing life as it was meant to be." Seeing life as it was meant to be. Not as how you fantasized about it, but what is real. Look, I read the news and get discouraged. I reflect on my own foolishness and am startled. But rather than give up, Easter challenges me to see even defeat in a whole new way. To embrace the idea that following Jesus is about risk. It's about being committed to doing what's right. It's about being vulnerable, about facing all sorts of hardships. And with the Spirit's guidance, coming out the other side with a new understanding about what's most important in life. Like the missionary who ran into some trouble translating the Bible into the native tongue of the people he was living with. The people had never in their lives seen a sheep, but with sheep and shepherds saturating the Bible, he had to do something. So every sheep in his translation suddenly turned into a buffalo. And from then on, the native people understood and loved all the biblical stories about buffaloes. Does it matter that the sheep became buffaloes? Not in the slightest. Whether the stories are about sheep or buffaloes, they're all meant to convey a way of seeing the world in a way that defies expectations. Does it matter that there are five different biblical accounts of Easter, none of which match in order of events, characters, or dialogue? Not in the slightest. Whether the story has one angel or two, five women or one, earthquakes or not, They're all meant to convey a seeing of the world that defies expectations. Whatever the first Christians experienced in those darkest of moments, with Jesus dead, his followers scattered, their cause betrayed, something happened that gave them a whole new way of seeing the world. Our Emmaus followers couldn't see Jesus right in front of them until he broke bread and shared it. Then guess what? They got it. Now, did Emmaus ever actually happen? Well, considering the fact that the story is only in Luke, this vague location, the questionable identity of the disciples, magical disappearance of the figure of Jesus, it makes sense to embrace what John Dominic Crossan suggests. Who knows if Emmaus ever really happened exactly the way it appears in Scripture? The important thing to remember is that even if Emmaus never happened, Emmaus always happens. Then and there, here and now, we see the Spirit at work in the most common and unexpected moments. The divine breaks in and reminds us of the sacredness of so much of what we take for granted. But what it took was Jesus' followers seeing reality in a whole new way, a public execution becoming a sign of hope, what first appears as death becoming a sign of new life. And on the road to Emmaus, where the disciples recognize Jesus not in the teaching, not in the believing, but in the simplest act of sharing a meal. All you have to do is see it. Hall of Fame baseball umpire Bill Clem used to tell a story about umpires. The first umpire said, "Some pitches are balls and some are strikes, and I calls them as they are." The second umpire said, "Well, some pitches are balls and some are strikes, and I calls them as I see them." But the third umpire said, "Some pitches are balls and some are strikes, but they ain't nothing till I calls them." Our perception of things affects the world in a very real way. And in large part, whatever you make of Easter is what you make of it. It ain't nothing till you call it. For some, that means meditating on a miraculous wonder from long ago. But for me, it's about being reminded that more often than not, real change for the good often comes when difficult circumstances force us to see the world in a new way. That's what Easter did for Jesus' first followers. And if we're lucky, it'll do the same for us. Easter ain't nothing till you call it. So keep your eyes peeled. And may the Spirit show you how to see the world in fresh and unexpected ways. Happy Easter.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information, or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.